Welcome to Eye to the Future, a podcast of Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Are humans the enemy? Should pigs and peas have constitutional rights? Today on Eye to the Future, Joshua Youngkin continues his discussion on the new book and documentary film, The War on Humans, with the book's author, Discovery Institute Senior Fellow and bioethicist, Wesley J. Smith. Smith leads Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism. In part two of this series, you'll hear about how the conservation movement turned into an anti-human movement, and how this affects humans, especially in the developing world and in marginalized people groups. Be sure to visit www.waronhumans.com to get more information about the digital book and the documentary.
Well, Wesley, you've written a book, and I would love for you to introduce it to the audience and listenership here, what it's about and what you're trying to do with it.
Thank you. You know, it's called The War on Humans, and it is about the radical environmental movement and how it has taken really the tremendously beneficial environmental movement of Theodore Roosevelt and conservation and setting up the national parks and the work that's been done in my lifetime to clean up dirty air and to clean up polluted water and so forth. And it has turned it into an anti-human path, a deep misanthropy, where rather than human beings as being required and duty-bound to treat the environment properly, as we prosper and as we build a strong and vibrant, thriving for mankind, instead we are viewed as the enemy of the planet. We are the cancer on Earth. We are the destroyers of the Earth. We are the virus that is killing Gaia, the living planet. And it's almost setting up an Earth religion. You have a strong movement coming along called the Rights of Nature that literally has passed laws in two countries, Ecuador and Bolivia, more than 30 cities in the United States, saying that nature has rights. It's almost a right to life. And I can read to you what these nature rights are so you can see what I'm talking about, because I really think people need to hear it firsthand from what the terminology is. And this is from Ecuador's constitution. Nature, or Pachamama, which is the earth goddess, where life is reproduced and exists, has the right to exist, persist, maintain, and regenerate its vital cycles, structures, function, and processes in evolution. That's a right to life for nature. Santa Monica, as an example, has passed that very law without mentioning Pachamama, which says that Santa Monica has recognized the rights of people, natural communities, and ecosystems to exist, regenerate, and flourish. Now, what does that mean? Well, I grew up in Los Angeles. I know Santa Monica like the back of my hand. There's no nature left in Santa Monica. It's ideological, unless they want to destroy the pier to save the mackerel, which they're not about to do. Why are they doing that? It's a matter of saying that the backbone of Western civilization, the unique importance of human beings, must be destroyed, because the hard environmental radicals view us as the enemies of the planet. And so what does nature rights do? It gives anyone and everyone a right to sue on behalf of nature for its right to exist and flourish and persist, who might not like a human action being taken, such as, say, building housing projects, or more broadly, mining copper or the Alberta tar sands. And if you have the rights of nature that are co-equal, which is what the point is, to those of human beings, then if you have to give equal consideration to nature, what happens? Human thriving grinds to a halt, because the ideologues can go into court and say, you are destroying this aspect of nature with this project. And then a court has to decide whether the human need outweighs the equal needs of the, quote, inhabitants of whatever that particular area is. In the United States, it's a way to try to stop fracking. Pittsburgh passed a law to that extent. Of course, there would never be any fracking in Santa Monica, although there are oil fields off the coast there, I suppose. But the idea is very subversive, not only to the value of human life, but to the concept of rights. If everything has rights, then nothing does. Because rights, instead of being precious and protecting freedom, become something that can be imposed across the broad array of life on the planet. So think of nature rights as a shield, seeking to protect the, quote, Earth from large-scale development. Concomitantly with nature rights, which, by the way, is supported by Ban Ki-moon, who is the Secretary General of the United Nations, and nature rights as proposed in the draft treaty for the United Nations to fight global warming, just so you know how high this has already gotten. Concomitantly, there is now a move called ecocide, which seeks to punish as a felony akin to genocide, not mass pollution such as the Exxon Valdez, but environmental, quote, murder of a project like the Alberta tar sands. They have even held a mock trial for ecocide in the English Supreme Court chambers, in which two fictional CEOs of Alberta tar sand developing companies were found guilty. And this, by the advocates of ecocide, deem it to be the fifth crime against peace. In other words, akin to genocide, akin to ethnic cleansing. Now, that's subversive on many levels. Number one, that you would equate prospering from energy extraction to Auschwitz, which is basically what they're doing, is stunning in and of itself, but that you would think that the inhabitants, which is what the term ecocide seeks to protect, the inhabitants of a territory, they're not talking about human beings. They're talking about weeds and snails and snakes and birds and trees. All of the, quote, inhabitants of nature come to be equivalent to the needs of people. This is very destructive. And it's, in a sense, as I mentioned earlier, almost a quasi-Earth religion.
Is it really religious in motivation, or is it perhaps, at a certain sense, religious, but also meant to enrich and empower those who hold control over what gets developed and what doesn't, almost like an extortion scheme?
I would call it nihilism, because it is almost a romanticizing of nature to the point of harming humans. So that our economy, imagine if we couldn't engage in energy extraction, which many advocates of ecocide think by definition, if it's not renewable, it's ecocide. If we could not engage in energy extraction, what would happen to our economy, which is already struggling? Even worse, what will happen to the destitute in the developing world, which may be very resource rich, but because of various issues, whether it's a culture, past colonialism, or whatever, they have not been able to get their rule of law together, their economies together to actually take advantage of the riches that are literally under their feet, they wouldn't be able to develop their societies and their economies at all. It's a prescription for enforced poverty in the name of loving and saving the planet, but it's a very romanticized version of nature. It's almost like Rousseau. And to some, I do believe it is a form of paganistic earth religion. That is, what matters is the creation itself. That's what we worship. That's what we care most about. Of course, we all should care about creation or the environment, but not to the expense of human beings not being able to thrive. It's only been in the last several hundred years that most, in the West anyway, most human beings have had a decent standard of living. Before that, we have been at the complete subject to whatever vicissitudes of life the natural world brought to us. Mm-hmm. We're now actually able to be somewhat, we're never going to be totally free of it, mm-hmm. but somewhat we've been able to step outside of that and kind of control what happens to us instead of being at the effect of it. Right. This will go away if nature has rights and or ecocide becomes the sword punishing environmental, quote, destruction, although most of the time we're not talking about destruction. We're talking about the use of land, which can then be remediated and returned to a good state. Mm-hmm. We're eating our own tails. When you give up on human exceptionalism, when you say, you know, being human isn't important in and of itself, when you say that we're just another animal in the forest, you go a little crazy. And I think ecocide and nature rights are examples of that, because they aren't going to materially help the natural world. Human duty does that. Human duty to make sure that we don't unnecessarily destroy wilderness areas, that when we do have to use the land for our own benefit, we use it and then we do our best to restore the land into a decent state. that we have a duty to each other to make sure that our lives are not destitution, that our lives are not reduced to a state of impoverishment, which has been the lot of so much of humankind during our entire time on this planet. Now, just when we're able to actually escape that kind of fate, except for the very few of us in the past, are we going to turn away from that? Well, that's what these people would do, and it's anti-human. It's anti-human in its advocacy, and it's anti-human in its implications, and it's anti-human in its effects.
Environmentalism, you said, is not necessarily completely without merit or,
of course,
or redeeming value.
Yeah.
It's just when it's been co-opted by religionists, essentially, for their own religious, religious purposes.
This anti-human aspect of environmentalism really started to the fore, say, in the 70s with deep ecology, where the idea was we have to have a radical human depopulation to under 1 billion to protect the planet, and that the planet should be given equal consideration. And, you know, at that, for a long time, that was, okay, those are fringe people, those are off at the edges. But that fringe, and Gaia theory of the Earth as a living organism, that fringe radical element has steadily eaten from the outside toward the center. And certainly it isn't the totally controlling aspect of environmentalism now, but it's tremendously influential. When you take a look at some of the anti-human and self-loathing things the global warming advocates have said about human beings, how they have gone along with the deep ecology view that we have to, in order to save the planet, reduce humankind to under 1 billion. Do you know what it would take to reduce humankind to under 1 billion?
Yes.
Genocide. It would take mass genocide. You look at the China one-child policy, which has been tyranny, where you've had forced abortion, where you've had female infanticide. That has not stopped the growth of the Chinese population. It's only slowed the level of growth, and that's tyranny, and that's oppression. If you really wanted to cause a massive drop in actual numbers of human beings, the only way to do that would be through something so evil and horrendous that the people who are proposing it would never engage in it. But if you get somebody who would, and there are people who are so twisted that they would, you know, it could be Katie bar the door. I think a lot of these people are so idealistic in a certain sense, they don't know the harm that they can cause once we start looking at ourselves as the enemy, as the killer of the earth, as the cause of so much suffering on the planet. Then what human suffering has to be caused in order to alleviate that, somebody, if they had the power and the twisted mindset, could do some very real damage to humankind.
And sometimes what these would-be tyrants need is a doctrine.
A pretext, too.
A pretext. An ideological base.
That's correct. And you are seeing an increase in the idea of authoritarianism in environmentalism, too. That you're beginning to see advocacy that, well, we can't have democracy because democracy, people won't give up what they have to give up, and we know better. At best, that leads to a technocracy where the control are ruled by so-called experts. At worst, it could lead to something like what's happening in China with the agenda to protect the planet, but actually causing tremendous harm to individual human beings and human societies.
That's the end of part two of this series of interviews with Wesley J. Smith, author of the new digital book, The War on Humans, and contributor to the new documentary film of the same name. For more information about the book and the film, be sure to visit www.waronhumans.com. That's www.waronhumans.com. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.